This is lecture number 7 on the Major Prophets by Robert Vannoy of Biblical Theological Seminary. And lecture 7, as previous and subsequent lectures, deal with the prophet Isaiah. Lecture number 7. We've been discussing Isaiah chapter 7. We were in the midst of looking at verses 13 through 16 at the end of the last hour. Remember, I indicated that there are generally three ways in which those verses have been treated by interpreters. Some will try to apply them all to the current situation of the Syro-Ephraimite War, and assume that the sign of the birth in verse 14 of chapter 7 is the child that is born either to Ahaz the king or to Isaiah the prophet. Others have tried to apply the entire passage to the birth of Jesus Christ on the basis of the Matthew citation of this verse. Matthew does apply it to Christ. Neither of those two alternatives seems to do justice to the specifics of the passage, because in verse 13 there seems to be a rebuke to Ahaz the king in Isaiah's time. Notice what Isaiah says to Ahaz. "Hear now, O house of David, is it a small thing for you to weary men? But will you also weary my God?" And verses 15 to 16 seem very clearly to speak of the contemporary situation, particularly verse 16. Quote, "For before the child shall know to refuse the evil and choose the good, the land you abhor shall be forsaken of both her kings." End quote. So it seems that it can't be specifically applied to the birth of Christ, for it appears to be a sign that's more immediate in Isaiah's time while he's speaking to Ahaz. So that's led some to advocate a multiple or dual fulfillment in which the passage speaks both to the contemporary child of Isaiah and also to Christ. I gave you Walter Kaiser as an illustration of that position. That raises another issue of multiple sense. I think we need to be very careful about that, but it also raises the question of the meaning of the term Alma in the Hebrew. In the King James Version, it translates it as a virgin shall conceive, and Alma is taken to be a virgin. Well, if this is Isaiah's wife, how can that apply to the mother of that child? It seems best to take verses as words of rebuke to Ahaz on the one hand, where he says, "You are in effect an unworthy representative of the house of David, so you will be replaced." On the other hand, it is a rebuke to Ahaz, but on the other, it is directed to a different audience. There are words of comfort to the godly people still in the land in Isaiah's time. Verse 13 is rebuke to Ahaz, whereas verses 15 and 16 are comfort for the godly people of the land. The thing combines those two thoughts together and is something you have to bring to the text, and admittedly, that is a difficult part of interpretation here. The thing that binds them together is to say, on the assumption that if he were to be born within the year, that is the child that is prophesied here, within the normal time of pregnancy, which would be within a year, 9 months to be exact, then the things that Isaiah is speaking of would happen. In other words, it's not a prophecy that he will be born then, but Isaiah used the term of pregnancy as a basis for the measurement of time. Assuming that if he were born presently, then before he would know enough to distinguish right from wrong, before the child would or could know that the invading kingdoms would be gone. I don't think the prophecy says specifically when the child is coming. The assumption is that if he were to come within a year, before he was more than a little older, where he could tell the difference between right and wrong, the Syrians and the Ephraimites would be gone. I want to go a bit further in this question of the word Alma. The Hebrew term is Alma, and it is translated, as I said before, a virgin, in, "Behold, a virgin shall conceive and bear a son." I think that that is a strong objection to understanding the specifics of verse 14 to be referring either to the king's wife or to the wife of Isaiah having a son. There is no indication that Ahaz's wife was a virgin or that the wife of Isaiah was a virgin. In fact, we know that Isaiah already had a son, named Shear Yashub, when Isaiah went out to meet and to confront King Isaiah with this prophecy. God told him, in fact, to take his son, Shear Yashub, and we see that in Isaiah chapter 7, verse 3. Now, there have been a number of interpreters who have argued that the term Alma does not really mean virgin, but simply means a young woman. Therefore, the term might refer to Isaiah's wife or even to Ahaz's wife. And in fact, if you look at the Revised Standard Version translation of Isaiah chapter 7, verse 14, it says, and I quote here, "Behold, the young woman shall conceive," end quote. Now, there is a footnote in the RSV that says, or virgin, for this particular term, young woman, but as I said, that's put in a footnote. If you look at the New English Bible, it simply says the young woman will conceive, and there isn't even a footnote to warn you that this word might mean virgin. It just leaves it as it is, as young woman. So it removes entirely any suggestion of a virgin birth. The question is then, what does this Hebrew term Alma, translated virgin, really mean? Let me make a few comments on that. First, the word Alma is not the usual word for virgin. Virgin is normally translated by a different Hebrew word, not Alma. Normally, the word translated virgin is the Hebrew word Bethulah. You might well say, if Bethulah is the term commonly used for virgin, why did Isaiah not use Bethulah instead of Alma to make everything clear? Well, look at your citation on page 17, the first paragraph at the top of the page. This is taken from E.J. Young's volume, one of his three-volume commentaries on Isaiah, and this is page 288, the first paragraph that we're looking at here. Notice what Young says, and I'm quoting him here. In Joel chapter 1, verse 8, the Bethulah is clearly a married woman. And in later Aramaic incantation texts, the Aramaic equivalent of Bethulah refers to a married woman. If Isaiah had used this word, Bethulah, he would have left us in confusion. We could not have known precisely what he had in mind. Was he there speaking of one who was truly a virgin? Or did he rather have in mind one who was betrothed, or one who was actually a wife? In light of these considerations, it appears that Isaiah's choice of the word Alma was deliberate. It seems to be the only word in the language which unequivocally signifies an unmarried woman. No other available Hebrew word would clearly communicate that the one whom it designates was unmarried. Consequently, no other word would have been suitable for fulfilling the requirements of the sign, such as the context demanded. None of these other words were pointing to an unusual word. Only Alma makes clear that the mother was unmarried. And that's the end of Young's quote. Now, he goes on in the next paragraph, and I quote him again. If, however, the mother is a married woman, then was the child illegitimate or not? If the child were illegitimate, would such a birth be a sign? The whole context, indeed, the whole biblical context, rules this out. On the other hand, if the mother were a good woman, then the birth would be out of the ordinary, and an unusual birth where the mother is unmarried and a good woman. When this fact is understood, it becomes apparent in all of history that there is only one for whom this could be predicted, and that was Mary, the mother of the Lord Jesus. End quote. You notice that Young does not there lay stress for the need of the term Alma. He lays stress on the unmarried state more than on the virginity aspect of the meaning of the word. Not that the word does not include the idea of virginity. But the central significance in the word Alma seems to be unmarried, if you look at it in the Hebrew. The confusion with Bethulah is that sometimes it is translated virgin, but is not always about an unmarried woman. That is to say, Bethulah is not always an unmarried woman. There are cases where she is really not an unmarried woman, yet she is called Bethulah. So the term Alma indicates an unmarried woman. Secondly, the term Alma is used to refer to a virgin. If you look at those instances of usage, you can find that in no case is she a married woman. It is always used for an unmarried woman. Now, in at least one case, it's clear that the word alma designates one who is not only unmarried, but that she is a virgin as well. That's in Genesis chapter 24. If you turn to Genesis chapter 24, that's the story of Abraham sending his servant to find a wife for Isaac. There's some interesting terminology used there in that passage. If you look at verse 43 of Genesis 24, you read, this is the servant speaking, and I'm quoting, "Behold, I stand by the well of water, and it shall come to pass that when the virgin, Alma, comes forth to draw water, and I say to her, give me, I pray thee, a little water of thy pitcher to drink. And she say to me, both drink thou, and I will also draw for thy camels. Let the same be the woman whom the Lord hath appointed out for my master's son." End quote. That's the King James translation, as you could probably tell. Take that verse 43 and compare that with the use of the term alma in verse 16. If you go back up to 15, you read, and I'm quoting here, "Behold, Rebekah came out, who was born to Bethuel, son of Milcah, the wife of Nahor, Abraham's brother, with her pitcher upon her shoulder. And the damsel," that is Na'ara, that is the Hebrew word for damsel, is Na'ara, and I continue the quote, "was very fair to look upon, a virgin." Now, Bethuelah is the term used here, a virgin. But then notice how Bethuelah is qualified. "Neither had any man known her." And that's a direct quote. "Neither had any man know her." Now, if Bethuelah was so clearly a virgin, why in the world add this qualifier, "neither had any man known her"? So ambiguity exists with the meaning of Bethuelah, but here that ambiguity is taken away when it said that she was a Bethuelah, neither had she known any man, and she went down to the well and filled her pitcher and came up. Now you see, you have in this chapter that she was a Na'ara, Bethuelah, and Alma, using all three Hebrew terms, and they are all used of Rebekah, and the context makes it very clear that she was unmarried and that she was a virgin. Dr. Alan McRae, I remember, years back, stated how I should define the word alma. He suggested that she was unmarried, or a young woman of marriageable age. A young woman of marriageable age, and one of those characteristics is that she be a virgin. Now, the third consideration is the way in which the Septuagint translated Isaiah chapter 7, verse 14, and specifically this word alma. When they translated this into Greek, the question is, how indeed did they translate the Hebrew alma? If you look at the Septuagint, you'll find that they translated the word parthenos, which is normally also translated virgin. In other words, parthenos is the Greek equivalent, in the minds of the Septuagint translators, of the Hebrew term alma. And if you go to Matthew chapter 1, verse 23, it says, quote, "Behold, the virgin shall be with child," end quote, and that is also the Greek word parthenos. Now, some have argued that that settles the case, for the Greek translators have used the word for virgin, and that gives us a clear understanding by how it's quoted in the New Testament. So it is clear, according to this logic, that alma, the Hebrew term in Isaiah 7:14, means virgin, because that is translated as parthenos by the Apostle Matthew, and he uses it in the sense of a virgin. However, it's not so straightforward as that, for the reason that parthenos is also ambiguous, much like Bethuelah. Look at your citation page on page 32 at the bottom of the page. This is a passage taken from Harry Orlinsky's in the Interpreter's Bible Dictionary, and this is his article on the term virgin. And he says, quote, "Whether parthenos was a virgin or not was a secondary matter to be determined possibly by the context. Indeed, the term parthenias denoted an unmarried woman, and the name parthenos was sometimes honorifically used for the sacred prostitute, Thus, there is that name Parthenos for the temple in Athens. We call that the Parthenon now. When early Christianity developed the belief of the virgin birth of Jesus, it was natural to point to a possible proof text in Isaiah chapter 7:14, which speaks of a virgin, and in the Septuagint, that's the term Parthenos, and consequently of the Hebrew term that was translated with Parthenos is the term Alma, and therefore Alma would imply a virgin. And we end Orlinsky's quote at that point. But what Orlinsky points out there, you see, is that Parthenos, much like Bethulah, is not always totally clear because some usages obscure that meaning of virgin. Notice he says whether Parthenos indicates a virgin or not needs to be determined by the context. And that's where I think the Matthew context is also important, because look at Matthew chapter 1, verse 18. It says, and I quote here this very familiar passage, "Now the birth of Jesus was this way. When, as his mother Mary was espoused to Joseph, before they came together, she was found with child from the Holy Spirit." End quote. So when you use Parthenos in that context with that qualifier, it's like the qualifier for Alma in Bethulah back in Genesis 24. It is clear that Parthenos in the Matthew passage is used to indicate virginity because he uses it of Mary before she came together with Joseph. You notice in verse 25, it is made doubly clear. We see, quote, "He knew her not until she had brought forth her firstborn son," end quote. So there's no question at all that in Matthew there is a double qualifier with the term Parthenos. So it seems to me quite clear here, in fact, in Isaiah chapter 7, that it speaks in verse 14 of the virgin birth. It seems very difficult to apply that to either later King Hezekiah or to the son of Isaiah at that time. It seems to be talking of the coming of Christ. So verse 13 is a rebuke to Ahaz. "You are going to be replaced," is what Isaiah tells him. And then, assuming the child were to be born within the year, verses 15 and 16 give comfort, not rebuke, but comfort to the godly remnant that he is speaking to. So in verses 15 and 16, you have a transition of thought, but there is no more continuation of rebuke to Ahaz, only the words of comfort to God's people. Now, if you look at page 15 of your citations, at the bottom of the page, the last paragraph, the commentator Hassel suggests that in his article from 1987, and I quote here, "After Isaiah's long-range pronouncement, the prophet turns to the other immediate peril, the Syro-Ephraimite coalition, and follows the pattern that fits prominent in his writings by supporting his long-term prediction with a short-range prediction that is able to be observed by his contemporaries. The long-range prophecies, Isaiah chapter 7, verse 14 and 15, have a long time to be fulfilled, and the short-term prophecy is Isaiah chapter 7, verse 16. Now, whether you break it between 15 and 16 or between 14 and 15:16 is altogether up to the interpreter." And that's the end of the quote by Hassel Bullock, actually. There are some difficult interpretive problems here, but I understand chapter 8 in much the same way that Hassel Bullock does, that there is a short-term prediction that certifies a certain fulfillment of the long-term fulfillment. And I don't think that you can compare the child of chapter 8 with the child of chapter 7, because the child of chapter 8 is clearly the son of Isaiah. That child is not of a virgin birth. Besides, he's given the name Maher Shalal Hashbaz, not Emmanuel. There are two different children. There was the one who was born immediately. In fact, more quickly, you might say, than the one in chapter 7, because of the one in chapter 7, it says, "Before the child can distinguish between good and evil, the evil you are facing will be gone." That is to say, the kingdoms that had attacked Judah will be gone. Of the one in chapter 8, it says that before he will be able to say, "My father and mother," probably earlier, within a year of the birth, the invaders will be gone. So the prophecy of chapter 8 must have been a bit later. It was fulfilled more quickly, but it's a different child, and it has a different name. It certainly didn't have a virgin for a mother. The child in chapter 8 is not the same child as the one in chapter 7. Admittedly, the child in chapter 8 fulfills a similar purpose, but it does it even more quickly, in other words, than the child in chapter 7. You have the child that is born within a year before it can distinguish between good and evil. Then you come to chapter 8, and you have a child who seems to indicate before it can say, "My father," or "My mother," the problem will be solved. In verse 4 of chapter 8, we read, quote, "Before the child shall have the knowledge to cry, 'My mother and father,' the riches of Damascus in the spoil of Samaria shall be taken away before the king of Assyria," end quote. It seems that this is a shorter time than the one predicted in chapter 7. So there are two different children, two different prophecies, and two different times. Then this fulfillment can be observed so that the birth of a child can serve as a confirmation of the authenticity of the other long-range prophecy of the child by the virgin. In other words, before Christ was born, those kings were gone. If you take it in the immediate context, those people are being told that within 2 or 3 years, the problem, that is, the Syrians and the Ephraimites invading Judah, will be gone. It's not something they could have confirmed. Long-term uncertain future is made certain by the short-term prophecy. So the Syro-Ephraimite alliance against Judah is a short-term problem, and within a few years, it would have passed. I think they heard the prophecy that Ahaz is an unworthy occupant of the throne of David, who is going to be replaced. If a child were born today or within a year, before the child was more than a couple years old, the problem would pass. The birth of the child is simply used as a basis of time measurement. It does not say that the child will be definitely born, but if he were to be born, it seems to me that this holds together the two passages. It's clear in the next chapter, for there's a parallel there. Well, let's move on. This is a difficult interpretive problem, and you can think further on it and come to your own conclusion. In chapter 7, verses 17 to 25, you find the results of Ahaz's scheme. Remember, Ahaz's scheme was to conclude an alliance with Assyria in order to relieve the threat from Ephraim and Syria. What Isaiah does in verses 17 to 25 is to describe the ultimate effect of Ahaz's reliance on the king of Assyria. Notice in verse 17 what he says. "The Lord will bring on you and on your people and on the house of your father a time unlike any since Ephraim broke away from Judah. He will bring the king of Assyria." And so Ahaz made an alliance assuming everything would be quiet. But the Lord says that the king of Assyria is going to come down on you. Notice what Isaiah says. "In that day the Lord will whistle for flies from the distant streams of Egypt and for bees from the land of Assyria. They will all come and settle in the steep ravines and in the crevices in the rocks, on all the thorn bushes and on all the water holes." And then notice the phrase here. "In that day the Lord will use a razor hired from beyond the river, the king of Assyria, to shave your heads and hair of your legs, and to take off your beards as well." So the Lord says through Isaiah that the Lord will shave with a razor that is hired. The razor that is hired is Assyria. Assyria was hired by Ahaz already to shave Syria and Israel, or Ephraim, and what Isaiah says is that Assyria is going to come and shave Judah as well. "The Lord shall shave with the razor that is hired," Isaiah says, "namely those beyond the river, namely the king of Assyria." And he goes on to say, "to shave your head and the hair of your legs, and to take off your beards as well. In that day a man will keep alive a young cow and 2 goats, and because of the abundance of the milk they give, he will have curds to eat. All who remain in the land will eat curds and honey. In that day, in every place where there were 1,000 vines worth 1,000 silver shekels, there will be only briars and thorns. Men will go there with bow and arrow, for the land will be covered with briars and thorns. As for all the hills, once cultivated by a hoe, you will no longer go there for fear of the briars and the thorns. They will become places where cattle are turned loose and where sheep run." Those were the words of Isaiah. Now, in other words, what Isaiah is saying is that the conditions are going to be that agriculture will suffer because of the lack of cultivation. Vineyards will be destroyed, and grazing space will emerge that doesn't require a lot of agricultural attention. This will be the devastation that's going to come upon the land. The agent of this devastation will be Assyria. This is the very country that Ahaz has put his trust in to deliver him from the war waged upon him by the northern kingdom and by Syria. Now, the outcome of this alliance that Ahaz made with the Assyrians happened in the time of Hezekiah, his son. The eventuation of this alliance is described in detail in chapters 36 to 39 of Isaiah. That's the historical section that divides between the two major sections of the book of Isaiah. In the time of Hezekiah, Ahaz's son, Sennacherib, the Assyrian king, comes against Jerusalem, and he besieges Jerusalem, so that Hezekiah reaps later what Ahaz had sown earlier. Then, the interesting thing is, if you look at chapter 36, verse 2, in the time of Ahaz's son Hezekiah, when Sennacherib is threatening Jerusalem, you read in verse 2, quote, "And the king of Assyria sent Rabshakeh from Lachish to Jerusalem unto King Hezekiah with a great army," end quote. And then note the last phrase, and I'm quoting again from Isaiah, "And he," meaning the Rabshakeh, "stood by the conduit of the upper pool in the highway of the fuller's field," end quote. Remember that location from before. Go back to Isaiah chapter 7, verse 3, where it says, "And then the Lord said to Isaiah, Go forth now and meet Ahaz, you and Shear-Yashub, your son, at the end of the conduit of the upper pool in the highway of the fuller's field." In other words, the very spot where Isaiah had confronted Ahaz, telling him to trust in the Lord and find security and confidence in the Lord, this threat against you is not going to succeed. Ahaz clearly did not want to trust the Lord. Instead, he trusted in Assyria and made an alliance with Assyria. In that very spot, Isaiah had warned him, that day, the messenger of Assyria now stands and calls for Hezekiah's submission a generation later. So that is the ultimate eventuation of Ahaz's conduct in the Syrio-Ephraimite War. Well, let's go on to chapter 8, and we're still in this section of the so-called Book of Emmanuel. It seems that the historical background in chapter 8 and the general teaching of chapter 8 is very similar to that of chapter 7. Verses 1 to 4 read, quote, "The Lord said to me, Take a large scroll and write on it with an ordinary pen, Maher Shalal Hashbaz, and I will call in Uriah the priest and Zechariah, son of Jeberechiah, as reliable witnesses for me. Then I went to the prophetess, and she did conceive and gave birth to a son. And the Lord said to me, Name him Maher Shalal Hashbaz. For before the boy knows how to say, My father or my mother, the wealth of Damascus and the plunder of Samaria will be carried off by the king of Assyria." And that is from the NIV. So Isaiah is told to write concerning Maher Shalal Hashbaz. How would you like that for a name for your child? The King James translates that as a proper name. The NIV, or New International Version, does as well, although the NIV has a text note that says, Maher Shalal Hashbaz means, quote, quick to the plunder, swift to the spoil, end quote. I think there is some question of whether it should even be translated in the first instance as a proper name. Clearly, it's a symbolical name, the meaning of which is quick to the plunder, swift to the spoil. So, take a large scroll, Isaiah is told, and write on it with a pen, quick to the plunder, swift to the spoil. The English is just transliterated there as the name Maher Shalal Hashbaz. Now, it seems that the symbolism of that name, quick to the plunder, swift to the spoil, is that doom is coming to the two kingdoms of Israel and Syria. As is said in verse 4, the wealth of Damascus and the plunder of Samaria will be carried away by the king of Assyria. So destruction is coming towards them and eventually to Judah as well. You get the same vocabulary used in the verse about Judah in Isaiah chapter 10, verses 5 and 6. Look at what it says. Woe to the Assyrian, the rod of my anger, in whose hand is the club of my wrath. I send him against a godless nation. I dispatch him against the people who anger me, to seize loot and snatch plunder, and to trample them down like mud in the streets. So destruction is coming at the hands of the Assyrians on the northern kingdom, on Syria, but on Judah eventually as well. Thus this name, Maher Shalal Hashbaz, or quick to the plunder, swift to the spoil. Then a sign is given, which is very similar to that of Isaiah chapter 7, verses 14 to 16, although the time period is shorter here. We quote, before the child will be able to say, my father or my mother. Well, that would be some of the first words a child would speak, and here the child is born, and it is clearly not a virgin birth. For later on, it says, I, meaning Isaiah, went in unto the prophetess, and she conceived. So it seems to me that the child here cannot be the same child as the one predicted in chapter 7. The names are different. The mothers are different. Isaiah chapter 7, verse 14 is clearly messianic. But what you find historically is the Syro-Ephraimite War in 734 BC, and the fall of Damascus happened 2 years later after that threat, for Damascus fell in 732 BC. I quote Young again, who says that the prophecy of the birth of Isaiah's son could be verified as a pledge or earnest of the virgin's son. That is to say, the events of chapter 8 verify the events of chapter 7. That's similar to what Hassel Bullock said. Young suggests that there are two great figures coming, first to the people of God, Emmanuel, who will bring salvation, and second, to Ahaz and his followers, Assyria and its devastation. You find that in the fifth verse and following. It says, the Lord spoke to me again. Because this people has rejected the gently flowing waters of Shiloah and rejoices over Rezin and the son of Remaliah, end quote. And now what I think that's saying is, these people refuse the waters of Shiloah that go softly, and they rejoice in Rezin and in the son of Remaliah. These are kings of the north. And in other words, they rejoice in their defeat. Therefore, the Lord is about to bring against them the mighty flood waters of the river, the king of Assyria with all his pomp. It will overflow all its channels, run over all its banks, and sweep into Judah, swirling over it, passing through it, and reaching up to the neck. Its outspread wings will cover the breadth of your land, O Emmanuel. And with that, we end the quote. So Isaiah chapter 8, verses 5 to 8, show the results again in Ahaz's alliance with Assyria, with sole dependence on the king there, and not in the Lord. Since the people will not trust the Lord, this is symbolized by those gentle waters of Shiloah, and since they won't trust the Lord, the people refuse the waters of Shiloah, and since they refuse to trust the Lord in the waters of Shiloah, the Lord is going to bring a mighty river on them that will inundate the land, and that mighty river is Assyria. But the end of verse 8 is significant, because that river is going to flood the land, as it were. It is going to go over its banks and channels, and is going to go up to the neck. But it is not going to totally overload the land and be totally successful. The reason for that is that this is Emmanuel's land. So this river will overflow all its channels, run over all its banks, and sweep into Judah, swirling over it, passing through it, and reaching up to the neck. Its outspread wings will cover the breadth of your land, O Emmanuel. It's not Ahaz's land, ultimately. It's Emmanuel's land. And because of that, the king of Assyria is really powerless to do everything he would like to do, which is to destroy Judah totally. The king of Assyria is not permitted to do that. He can only go as far as the Lord permits him to go. He is carrying out the purposes of the Lord and doing what the Lord wants him to do, but this does not include the eradication of the land of Judah. Chapter 8, verses 9 and 10 show that the nations Assyria, Syria, and Ephraim will not succeed in taking Judah. You read in verse 9 of chapter 8, quote, "Raise the war cry, you nations, and be shattered. Listen, all you distant lands. Prepare for battle and be shattered. Devise your strategy, but it will be thwarted. Propose your plan, but it will not stand, for the Lord is with us." End quote. Young says that just as earlier the fact of coming doom was symbolically expressed in the name of Isaiah's child, Maher Shalal Hashbaz, so here the fact that deliverance is getting a symbolic expression in the virgin's child, Emmanuel. It is Emmanuel's land, so Assyria can only go as far as God permits Assyria to go. It's not going to be complete removal of the Judean kingdom. Again, that prediction is clearly fulfilled in the time of Hezekiah in the second part of the book, Isaiah chapters 36 to 39. The Assyrians are all ready to take Jerusalem when the Lord intervenes and sends a plague on Sennacherib and his troops. Although the Assyrian annals say that Sennacherib had Hezekiah closed up, quote, like a bird in the cage, he did not take Jerusalem, he did not, quote, pluck the bird in the cage, end quote, as he would have said had he taken Jerusalem and Hezekiah. All right, chapter 8, verses 11 to 22 are words of exhortation for the Israelites in view of the current situation. I'm not going to spend much time on those verses, but let's read a few of them. Chapter 8, verses 13 to 14, we read, "The Lord Almighty is the one you are to regard as holy. He is the one you are to fear. He is the one you are to dread, and he will be a sanctuary. But for both houses of Israel, he will be a stone that causes men to stumble and a rock that makes them fall." Well, what fear is he talking about? The fear of the Lord. And he goes on and says, "Sanctify the Lord. Let him be your fear. Let him be your dread." And then in chapter 8, verses 19 and 20, we read, quote, "When men tell you to consult mediums and spiritists who whisper and mutter, should not a people inquire of their God? Why consult the dead on behalf of the living? To the law and to the testimony, if they do not speak according to this word, they have no light of dawn." End quote. So those are words of exhortation in view of the current situation. All right, let's take a 10-minute break, and then we'll move on to Isaiah chapter 9. And verse 21 of chapter 8 flows right into chapter 9 in the messianic prophecies there. So we'll take that up when we return from the break. This is the end of lecture number 7 by Robert Vinoy, lecture number 7 on the major prophets, specifically the prophet Isaiah.